everybody, and welcome to the Alternative Media. I am your host, Patrick Slattery. Today we've got a lot to talk about. We're going to start talking about the delegate selection mess in the Republican, well, and the Democratic primaries. We've got this whole delegate selection system that really nobody, hardly anybody, understands. And but it's going to be, we're going to be hearing a lot about it all summer long. And we've had Donald Trump has been complaining. He's had some, I would say, some legitimate complaints. I saw on last night on PBS, Reince Priebus. He is making the rounds. Don Gate. He is making the rounds, and he's saying that the system is fair, and saying the system is fair. The rules are, well, actually, he's not even saying the system is fair. He's just saying that the rules are in place, and everybody knew the rules. He's not even saying it's fair. So I want to talk about that. And if I can get my producer to stop barking for a second, we'll be fine. Do we have our guest here? Don, are you here?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Thank you. Thank you for being on the show again. We were talking a little bit earlier about this, the whole delegate selection business. And so as it stands right now, Donald Trump is on paper, at least, he seems to be 200 and something delegates ahead of Ted Cruz. He's got 750, 760, and he's trying to get to this magic number of 1,237. And, you know, we've got the New York primary coming up in a few days, and he'll probably win the vast majority of the delegates there, 80% or so of the delegates or more. He's so far ahead in the polls there. There's other states, in Mexican occupied California, I believe that is, they call it a winner take all state, but it's not strictly speaking winner take all. I don't think it's, there's the winner takes all of the statewide delegates, and then the congressional district delegates get divvied up. Is that correct? Or are you familiar with it, the situation?
That's my understanding. It's broken up into 54 district congressional districts. Each district produces three delegates, and that could work very favorably for Donald Trump, because you have some congressional districts which have very, very few Republicans. Like Nancy Pelosi's district probably has 300 Republicans, which is not very many, and if you could get, you know, a Trump victory there, you would get the same number of delegates as Orange County, which has a good many more Republicans. Orange County being a very strong traditional Republican stronghold. I've heard the guy who wrote the rules explain it on a couple of different talk show hosts, and that's my understanding of it.
It's right, kind of so
very subject how, you have to contemplate.
Yeah, and that's how I think Wisconsin and Missouri were that system. Florida was a real winner take all state, where whoever got more votes than anyone else got all of the delegates. So there's that level of how the delegates are apportioned. There is another level that we're not really talking about, and most people aren't very aware of, is who the delegates wind up being, how the delegates are actually appointed. So there's apportioned and there's appointed. Who will be the individuals? So the apportionment of the delegates, that varies state by state, election by election, you know, year by year, and the parties are different. And it changes. So I was actually writing a book on this. I was writing a user's manual to the 1992 presidential election. And I was writing all of, you know, I had a table that had all of the, you know, different states and their, whether they're caucus or primary, and how the delegates were apportioned, all this information. I had the candidate list. David Duke was, I just came across a manuscript, and of course I had a little section on David Duke, who was running in 1992. I'd kind of forgotten that I had a section on him in there. Didn't know him at the time, and but at any rate, so there's that issue. But then, who are the delegates? And this varies also from party to party, state election to state election. It varies. So there are states, Illinois, for instance, which has already had its election, Pennsylvania coming up, where you go in to the poll and you you pull the lever, or I guess nowadays you're pushing the button or touching the screen for the candidate. But then there is also a list of delegates. Now, so the candidate in Illinois and Pennsylvania, whoever gets the most votes wins those statewide delegates, which is only maybe 20% of the delegates available from the state. The rest of the delegates are running in these congressional district elections. And so the way it was in Illinois is you actually see the names of the delegates. Well, you see these names. Now, odds are they're not going to be very familiar names to you. You're not going to know who they are. And so the only way, if you were in Illinois or later this month, if you're in Pennsylvania, the only way to effectively vote for Trump is to know ahead of time who are the delegates that support Trump. And it's not going to be written on the election screen. It's not going to be written at the polling place. So you would have to have Trump volunteers standing in front of all the polling places, handing out little cards saying this is who to vote for. And, you know, that's a level of organization. I don't know if any of the candidates have that level of organization, but the establishment people have a big advantage because, of course, every precinct has a precinct captain that's responsible to the party. And if the party is going to be throwing its weight behind Cruz or throwing its weight behind Kasich, then those people there's going to be people in front of the precincts handing out cards with those names on it. And so that's one more challenge. But it's not like that in every state. It's like that in a few states where you're actually voting for the name of the delegate, names that you're not familiar with. In other cases, if the candidate wins is apportioned 17 delegates, then that candidate can actually appoint 17 people that he knows are loyal to him. So it varies greatly. And I don't know if Ted Cruz had such a great organization or such a great ground game, or if he simply has benefited from being, you know, the last opposition person standing, and the last establishment person standing, and so these party functionaries who have access to databases and access to volunteers, and if they're able to help him with things, if it's more him simply receiving all the organizational strength of the party establishment. I'm not sure which it is with him, but for Donald Trump, he came into this. It's a very complicated system, and I give his campaign manager credit with the media game and being able to do so well without spending a lot of money on advertising, but was kind of behind the curve in terms of this level of organization and understanding all the different rules and things. Now he's hired new and experienced people. He's got I forgot the man's name, but he actually managed Gerald Ford's convention in 1976. So somebody with a great deal of experience. And so I think Trump can probably catch up on this. So it's not as if all hope is lost. He can catch up on it. But I wanted to talk a bit about that. The apportionment, having the different apportionment rules from state to state is complicated enough, but Don, have you heard people talking on, you know, these talking heads or the experts on TV? Are they talking much about appointment, how the actual individuals become delegates? Are you hearing much about that?
Well, there's a huge amount of discussion on it on conservative talk radio, the mainstream shows such as Limbaugh and Michael Medved and Hugh Hewitt and most of the others, I would suspect. And it's an extraordinarily complicated procedure. It's very corrupt. There's a huge amount of room in it for bribery and corruption and vote stealing and all kinds of things. Interestingly enough, the great conservative activist woman Phyllis Schlafly made history in 1964 when she published her book A Choice Not an Echo in January of that year. And the subject of the book was the corruption of the Republican establishment and that establishment's success in stealing presidential nominations for the last, many, many years, most notably in the presidential election of 1940 when the Republican standard bearer was a Wall Street lawyer named Wendell Willkie, who was a globalist, who was a lifelong Democrat. He was not even a Republican. And many Republican rank and file people were quite astonished. They never heard of the guy. They had no knowledge who he was. He had never previously been in politics, never held any elective office. Rank and file Republicans were pretty stunned when their party nominated someone who was A, a Democrat, and B, someone that no one had ever heard of. So Republican Party manipulating of the nomination process is probably an old tradition. It may actually go back to the election of 1860, where Abraham Lincoln was chosen over several other candidates who are far better known and considered far more eligible, including United States Senator from New York, William H. Seward, who under the Lincoln administration became Lincoln's Secretary of State and played a very, very pivotal role during the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So, and he was responsible for the purchase of Alaska, ultimately, which was Seward's Folly.
Yeah,
we were told that, which was really one of his great achievements, certainly much less of a folly than the ill-conceived and genocidally conducted raping and looting expedition called the Civil War. In any case, in conservative media and on the internet, there has been an enormous amount of discussion of the nominating process. And the Republican Party establishment point of view seems to be, well, those are the rules. And you should have read the rules before you got involved in the process and, you know, that sort of thing. Well, I think that, The rules should be fair. I think people should be allowed to vote. I'm very suspicious of the whole caucus thing. It seems to be very, very ripe for corruption, and it certainly is the nominating process and the various so many aspects of it. It strikes me are designed to thwart rather than to determine or express the public will. It seems to me that it is a blatant contradiction of the founding principle of our country that our government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed. So it's something that's unintelligible. It is arbitrary. There's a simple in the law we would call an equitable argument, and that is the equitable argument that you see they take the position they can change the rules anytime and for any reason they want because this is a private organization. Well, even private organizations are subject to certain rules of law, and I think one legal
and it's a private organization that frankly is very much subsidized by the taxpayer. You know, it's these state secretaries of state who maintain voter lists and often in many states right. Are registering people as Republican or as Democrat, and they use the public election machinery for their primary elections.
Well, I'm troubled by the idea that so many people can go on this kind of formalistic legal basis. Well, those are the rules, and we can change them anytime we want. What do you say to the candidates who spent, and the donors who spent hundreds of millions of dollars in reliance on the rules in existence at that time, and the voters who went out and voted, Some donors are, not all donors are Sheldon Adelson are billionaires. Many of donors are modest, people of modest means. They've sent in their checks to their candidates. They've gone out and voted. And then at the last minute, either at the convention or immediately before the convention, and after many of these primaries have occurred, to say to the people, April fools, your votes really didn't count, strikes me almost more in the nature of a coup d'etat than a democratic process.
Well, that's right. And, you know, Rince Priebus says, well, these are the rules. They should know. They knew what the rules were when they got into the process. But, of course, the rules, a lot of these rules were set in October, and you don't have to be a professional researcher to be able to go back and look at what was being written last October. And last October, people were saying, hey, why hasn't this Trump phenomenon disappeared? I thought, you know, he was going to be the flavor of the month. In July, May sticks around in August and sticks around in September, and in October he was going up and up. And so a lot of these rule changes were very obviously to thwart Trump once they started taking him seriously. But with the Electoral College in the general election, that was prescribed in the Constitution. It was written about in the Constitution, and they didn't get it right. There was a lot of mistakes, and some of them became obvious with the election of 1800, where Adam Burr, who was supposed to be the vice presidential candidate, wound up in an electoral tie with Thomas Jefferson, who had won the election, and that threw the government into chaos. And so they wound up passing an amendment and changing the Constitution. There's still problems with it, which I want to get into later. But with the conventions and the primaries, this is something that developed ad hoc. It wasn't as if at any point in our history people just sat down and said, this is the way it should be. It developed ad hoc. The first national convention for a political party was in 1831, and it was the Anti-Masonic Party, good old Anti-Masonic Party, which I think nominated William Wirt. For their candidate for the next year's election. And it caught on. The Democrats and the Whigs started using conventions. Before that, the party's congressional delegations that selected their candidate. After about four or five elections, the Federalists hey, that sounds good. That's nice bumper music. We will be back after the break with more of this.
Bring me a dream. Bum, 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 bum. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen.
Bum, 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 bum.
Give him two lips like roses and clover.
Bum, 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 bum.
Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over.
Welcome back, The Alternative Media with Patrick Slattery, and I'm here with attorney Don Advo from behind the lines of Mexican-occupied California. And we are talking about our presidential election system and the a lot of problems. I think there's a lot of things we need to be aware of going into this summer. This is not just some academic exercise. I think we need to understand the system, and it's a really complicated system. And I was trying to go into a bit of the history. So before the Anti-Masonic Party, the good old Anti-Masonics, before they invented the political convention, the National Convention in 1831, it was the congressional delegation. So the Federalists had their congressional delegation, and the Democratic Republicans had theirs. Now, of course, after Aaron Burr shot Alexander Hamilton, the Federalists kind of faded into the woodwork. And by 1820, you had basically a one-party system. The Democratic Republicans, anybody that their congressional delegation was going to nominate would become the president. And, they nominated James Monroe. He became president. There was no problem with that. In fact, he won every state. They became so dominant, and there was wound up being a split. But once the convention started, Well, then who's going to the conventions? And you didn't have any presidential primaries. The presidential primaries, I think the first one was with 1908. It could have been 1912, but I think it was 1908, and I think it was Wisconsin. So before that, you had either conventions or you had caucuses or something else. So you didn't have presidential primaries. You didn't have the mass electorate participating in it directly. That's where we're coming from. And until 1968, you still, I mean, when Kennedy ran for president in 1960, he ran in the Wisconsin primary, ran in the West Virginia primary. The purpose of the primaries wasn't to amass delegates. The purpose of the primaries, because most states didn't have them, the purpose of competing in a primary was to show your electoral prowess, to show your appeal to the voters. So for Kennedy, going to West Virginia and winning the West Virginia primary was very important because Kennedy was Catholic and West Virginia didn't have hardly any Catholics, and it was important to show that he could win in a state like that. In 68, Humphrey won the Democratic nomination without competing in primaries. And then even when they did have primaries, a lot of primaries had nothing to do with the delegates. They were called beauty contests. For instance, in 1972, the New Jersey primary was won by Shirley Chisholm. You remember Shirley Chisholm, Don?
I do remember her. Which primary was that she won?
New Jersey. She won the New Jersey primary. How many delegates did she get out of it? None.
I don't know.
It had nothing to do with the delegates. And so probably the turnout was low. The idea or the expectation that you're going to go and vote and your vote's going to matter in terms of who gets nominated, that's something that people have come to expect because in the past four decades it's largely been the case. But it's not written into the rules. It's not written into the rules. It's and to the extent it is written in the rules, these are rules that can be changed in October because the establishment's worried about Trump, or can be, the delegate credentials can be challenged at the convention, and all sorts of things can happen, or the rules can be changed so that people who who don't like Trump but are were obligated by rules to vote for him in the first ballot, those rules might get changed. In fact, this is something Ronald Reagan tried to do in 1976. He was a little bit behind Ford in delegates. Neither one of them seemed to have the magic number, and he tried to get a rules change so that all delegates would be free to vote for whomever they wanted on the first ballot. He lost that, and when he lost that vote, he basically lost the nomination. But so there's a lot of – when Donald Trump talks about shenanigans, he's correct. When Rice Priebus talks about the rules, he's correct. But the rules are full of shenanigans. The rules are corrupt rules. And so people should know about that. Now one other thing I wanted to bring up, because we're going to have the convention. The Republican one will be in July. I think the Democrat one's in August. Then in November, there's the general election. And, those of you of a certain age out there would remember in the year 2000 when we had a contested general election, a contested electoral college, basically. The electoral votes of Florida were up in the air. And this is another thing people have come to expect, that when they vote in November in the general election, that they're voting for a candidate, and their vote, that vote that elects the president. Well, I hear bumper music. It's not Mr. Sandman, but it is bumper music. We're going to break again, but we're going to come back and learn more about the horrors of the electoral college. Get back after. And we're back. That is nice, mellow bumper music. That is bumper music I want to keep. I like that. Okay, so we're back, and I was finishing up my little mini lecture on the Electoral College. And so who is in the Electoral College? Now, if you've been listening to the David Duke show over the past few weeks, you would know that Bernie Sanders was a candidate for the Electoral College. And which party was he a candidate for the Electoral College? Who was he planning to represent in the Electoral College?
It was Socialist Workers?
The Socialist Workers Party, right? The Trotskyite Socialist Workers Party had their candidate, whose name slips my mind, had he won the vote in Vermont, Bernie Sanders would have cast one of the electoral votes that would be sent to Congress in December and opened up in January and read, and he would have been part of that process. But of course, I think Ronald Reagan won that year. Perhaps it was who was it? Maybe Carter won. I don't know. It was 1980. But
Ronald Reagan won in 80.
He won. Yeah, he won in the election in 80. I was wondering if he won in Vermont. He won in most states. He won Vermont in 84, I know, because he won everywhere except for Minnesota. But at any rate, so in some states, you're going to have the Socialist Workers Party would have passed around petitions, and Bernie Sanders' name would have been on the petition. And so the electors are, you know, they're registered with the state secretaries of state. And if that party candidate wins the most votes, and if that's the system where you win the most votes, because it hasn't always been the system. It hasn't always been the system where electors are elected by regular voters. Originally, electors were usually selected by state legislatures. Sometimes they were appointed by governors, but nowadays they're always elected by voters, but they don't have to be. And the last time there was a move to the contrary was in 2000, when there was all that controversy in Florida, and the Florida Assembly was poised to change the law so that the state assembly, which was under Republican control, would have appointed the electors, and it would have made the vote counting a moot point. And that would have been completely legal and constitutional, but it would have caused an uproar. Don, do you think what the Supreme Court did in 2000? Do you think that was a constitutional decision to stop the counting of the vote? As I recall, they stopped the counting of the vote to review whether the counting was constitutional. Then they decided the counting was legal, and then they decided the counting was legal, but it was too late to proceed with it. That was my recollection of the decision. Do you recall that decision?
I don't recall all the details of it. I do know that the federal courts acquired jurisdiction through the Voting Rights Act, and I think the first legal broadside was actually filed by Gore. Gore initiated legal proceedings, as I recall, and I'm going from memory, and then Bush either cross-complained or took additional proceedings of his own, and I think the argument, I don't think it was, there was a limit to how many recounts they could have. I think that was really the gist of it. Whether it was constitutional or not, it's kind of an obscure question. I mean, who really knows? I'm really not very well prepared to talk about it, but I know that the networks hired an auditing firm to audit the ballots, and they concluded that George W. Bush won Florida. Mm-hmm. So, you know, ABC, NBC, and CBS jointly hired one auditing firm to do that. And I know I never paid much attention to it after that. That was not widely known and not widely publicized. But a couple of the talk radio people did talk about it, and so it's kind of much ado about nothing, really. Yeah. If the vote, the actual vote count and the ballots were saved and they were counted by this auditing firm, and if it confirms that George W. Bush won the state, I think the rest of it is pretty much moot. It's amazing, for all of our emphasis on democracy and government by consent of the governed, how really strange our system is.
Mm-hmm. It is strange. I didn't think that the Supreme Court was... I thought it was wrong what they did. And when I say wrong, I mean, constitutionally, I didn't... questionable. But Bush had the Supreme Court not done what they did, and the Florida legislature had gone ahead and passed that bill allowing the legislature to appoint the delegates, to appoint the electors, then Bush would have won that way, and had a set of electors sent votes to Congress, which has been the case. It was a case in 1876 where you had, I think, four different states send in rival sets of electoral votes, and the Congress had to decide which it was. Had it gone to that, had Congress had to decide between rival electoral votes, they would have decided in Bush's favor, because you would have had a split decision between the House of Representatives and the Senate, and in that case, the decision maker is the governor of the state, and the governor of the state was Jeb Bush. So, you know, for all the whining that the Democrats have had, and it's, you know, it's possible that one candidate won by 500 or lost by 500. It's a very close vote. But no matter what, Bush was gonna win Florida. I don't think the Supreme Court decision was correct. But had they not gone ahead, there would have been, and things had just played out their constitutional process, Bush still would have won. But I'm raising that just as an example of the electoral state, because just as when we watch CNN or Fox after the primaries, we see these delegate numbers and tend to think that, oh, well, yeah, the delegates are, it's just a number. You know, we don't think of them as being people who vote and make decisions or and meet, but it's just a number, and it's kind of like, it's like football. This is how you score points, or basketball. This is how you score points. And they present the electoral votes that way too. But no, the electoral votes are votes of electors. And nowadays the electors are elected at polling places by regular voters, but it doesn't have to be that way. And we tend to think of the states as all being winner-take-all, but actually Maine and Nebraska are not winner-take-all. They have the two statewide electors who the statewide winner gets, and then they have congressional district-level electors, and the winner of each congressional elector, each congressional district gets that elector. It just so happens that they're small states, and I think in Maine's case, I think in both cases, it's since they went back to that system, it's always been a clean sweep. But it doesn't have to be that way. But the one other issue, though, is who is selecting the electors? And as I mentioned, in some states, you have this petition process. But another way is at the party conventions. The state conventions, and I've attended a couple of state conventions. At the state conventions, when they're deciding on who the delegates are to the conventions in the summer, at these same meetings, at these same conventions, they're also deciding who the party's electors will be. And I actually had my name put in nomination as an elector, not because I wanted to be an elector, but because it would give me a chance to address the state convention. And I addressed the state convention, saying that the electoral college system was messed up, and I put forward a proposal to abolish the Electoral College system and go to popular vote, and then I withdrew my name from nomination. You know, whether that's the best way to go or not, that's another story. But what the point is that people, human beings, are going to be appointed to be Republican electors or Democratic electors at these same conventions that have already become controversial. And just as you can have delegates who are going to be nominally Trump delegates but don't like Trump, and they have to vote for him on the first ballot because of party rules, but then will be free to vote however they want. These electors, they can vote for whoever they want. Now, there may be state laws saying that you have to vote the way the, you know, you have to vote for your party's person. But it's not as if they can be forced. I mean, they can decide to violate the state law, and maybe they would have to pay a fine or something. But they can, and they from time to time do vote. They're called faithless electors, and it's happened in recent history. It's in fact in the 2000 election, you had a faithless elector from the District of Columbia who was supposed to vote for Gore. And I think he just didn't vote. He just turned in a blank slate. You had, I think in 92, one of the electors who was supposed to vote for Dukakis for president and Benson for vice president switched. He voted for Benson for president and Dukakis for vice president. And in the 70s, elector from Maine was supposed to vote for the Republican. I think it was Nixon, and he voted for John Hospers, who was the libertarian candidate. And so it's always been, you know, a question like in a really close election where you could, like in the 2000 election, which was decided by, like, had two people, had forget about that faithless elector in D.C., but it had two people who were Republican electors that decided to vote for Gore instead, it would have thrown the election to the this November. Let's say Trump is the nominee, but let's say that you've had a whole bunch of people who despise Trump who have been selected as electors and wind up being the electors in various states. And what if you have a close election between Trump and Hillary, for instance? Do you think any of these neocons who are, you know, neocons, they're for Ted Cruz, would some of them vote for Hillary instead of Trump? Could that happen? What do you think, Don?
I don't know. I can't imagine any Hillary Clinton electors voting for Donald Trump. I can imagine some Donald Trump delegates voting for her, though. I think the Republican Party is sufficiently treacherous that just about any act of treachery and betrayal is conceivable for them. I will say that there does seem to be a measure of fear on their part. They seem to be very nervous about the upsurge of public anger and public outcry.
And when you say they, who are you speaking of?
Well, I think the party leadership. I know a lot of these conservative talk radio neocons are very, very disheartened by what they're saying. Specifically, I mean Dennis Prager, Michael Medved, Hugh Hewitt, who is kind of an interesting one. He's a Gentile. He's a lawyer, Harvard, served in the Reagan administration, intellectual conservative, very smart guy. He's been on talk radio for about 20 years. And he's married to a Jewish woman, and he often makes a reference to that. And he's very, very sensitive to Jewish issues and Jewish favoritism. And he is really walking on eggshells. You know from his past his hatred of immigration activists, his support for the third world tidal wave, his lies, his deception. You know he hates Trump, and you know he hates Trump people. But on his radio show, he is saying, oh, I'm Switzerland, I'm neutral, I'm not showing any favoritism. But, of course, he does show favoritism. He does hate Trump. He thinks Trump is out of the running because of Trump, because Trump did not sufficiently denounce and disavow David Duke.
That's written into the Constitution. I mean,
that's they're almost all locked. But the callers that call in just say we don't care. We've been lied to enough. We've had enough true conservatives, and we've never gotten anything except our factories shipped overseas, endless wars, and we're having to learn Spanish in order to get a job at the local McDonald's because most of the customers and the management are Spanish speaking. People are furious. I've never seen anything like this, and they're just beside themselves. Michael Medved goes into his anti-Trump tirades every day, and one caller called in and really made him sound like a fool. I was quite astonished because Medved is a pretty skilled guy, and you know they ride roughshod over the lay people who call into the show. But the callers are very strong. They're very strong. I think the Republican Party. I think they're walking a fine line. I think they don't want Trump to get it. But at the same token, they don't want to see the Republican Party destroyed. The Republican Party is a huge cash cow, a huge source of a very profitable livelihood for so many of these people for so many years.
So you're saying people like Michael Medved, Dennis Prager, they don't want the Republican Party destroyed?
No, they don't. They most definitely don't want it destroyed. And I think like Rents, Prevents, and these donors and these neocons and then the leadership of the party, not just the conservative talk radio people, I think they don't want the Republican Party destroyed because they know it has been for decades controlled opposition. It's swindled white people out of their votes, out of their donations, out of their activism. At least that's the way I feel about my lifelong affiliation to the Republican Party. So I think they're very, very much afraid. I think they are afraid of a meaningful third party, or perhaps I should say an actual second party.
Uh-huh. Well, I have a question.
Forming. And I think that there is a possibility. I think enough of the Sanders people could sit down and come together with some of the Trump people. Mm-hmm. And say, we need to take our country away from these potentates who are raping us.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. So you listen to, we'll have to get to that after the break.
Right.
And this is a good song. I want to keep this one too. All right. So we will be back after the break, after Freebird, with Don Advo and Patrick Slack. And welcome back to the show, The Alternative Media. And I was just posing a question for Don Advo. The question is, you have already you have some people like Robert Kagan, who's the husband of Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State, who's with a portfolio of causing World War III. And he's already switched sides to Hillary. He was the person who had founded the Project for a New American Century, which was neocon central. And that's where all of the people from the Bush-Cheney administration who were trying to start World War III back then, they came from that. He switched sides to Hillary already. So my question is, would these like conservative talk show hosts and other neocons, do you think that they don't want to split the Republican Party, they don't want to destroy the Republican Party, that they would get out of Trump's way, let him be the nominee, and then try to beat him by joining forces with Hillary for this election? And if Hillary presumably winning, then they would be able to get jobs in the Hillary administration. What do you think of that scenario?
Well, I think I think a lot of them are already doing it. As you mentioned, Robert Kagan's wife, and Victoria Nuland has already switched sides, and of course Bill Kristol. I mean, I think he's among the most notorious.
Has he come out for Hillary yet? Or is
I think he said so. I think he said he would rather see Hillary elected. That sounds to me like switching sides. Yeah, I think it's entirely possible they might allow Trump to achieve the nomination and then use their power to sabotage him and undermine him. They've done that before. They did it with the Barry Goldwater nomination in 1964. The Republican Party basically did nothing to help Barry Goldwater get elected to the presidency. So I'm not so sure what, you know, looking back, with hindsight, I'm not so sure what frightened them so much about Barry Goldwater. He was actually very liberal in many ways. He was very much pro-abortion, very pro-homosexual. Uh-huh. His wife was a founder of Planned Parenthood in Phoenix, Arizona. He helped arrange an illegal abortion for his daughter. Uh-huh. So he was not this great, he didn't like religious people very much. So he was not this great, social conservative. Everybody thinks he actually was. People were very, very disheartened by Barry Goldwater in the years that followed the 64 election. He actually became very liberal. And, I don't understand what the, I don't know. Looking back at all, I mean, I understood it then. I was a teenager then. I kind of got caught up in all the hoopla and everything and walked precincts. And I lived in Arizona at the time. And then my family moved to California just in time for me to volunteer for Ronald Reagan's first electoral run as governor of the state of California in 1966. And he, of course, was very profoundly disappointing at many levels. But I think the Republican Party is sufficiently flexible that they can leadership are sufficiently treacherous and sufficiently unprincipled and sufficiently resourceful that if they can't stop a Trump nomination, they can undermine Trump in so many other ways. You know, when you study Jewish power, how it works and how many tentacles it has, there are infinite possibilities for their treachery.
They sure are. Okay, we'll be back at the top of the hour with more of the alternative media with Patrick Slattery and John.